The police is the enemy. Everywhere the white man go, he bring misery. All throughout history, look it up. Everything them bald heads touch, they fuck it up. Every government he set up, it be corrupt.
Revolution. Revolution.
Dead prayers. People army. Steve Marley. Ghetto youth crew.
One of the goals behind the panel was having these discussions be based in the community, which is why we're out here at Little Burgundy rather than at CKUT in a cramped little studio.
These forums have a goal of providing a sort of necessary discussion of the history of police relations amidst communities of color in Montreal, specifically highlighting the experience of community members plus offering a diversity of perspectives on confronting the problems as well as implementing solutions. So each panel is to touch on these ideas, which is why we've invited David from the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality here today, as well as Peter from Black Youth in Action, to touch on some of these issues, to take us through the history, to talk about the experience of community members, and then to also talk about confronting these problems and implementing solutions. And so for tonight's discussion, we'll begin with David, a member of the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality, who's got at least an overview that you can provide of the 1980s and 90s. And then we'll hear from Peter Flagel about more on recent events concerning police relations among communities of color here in Montreal. So we'll begin with David.
Well, first I would say that to go back as far as 1987, in terms of relations between communities of colors and the police, is important. Why 1987? Because of the fact that it was on November 11th, 1987, that there was a particular incident in which a black person was killed by a Montreal police officer. From that incident stemmed a lot of changes in our justice system and even in the ways investigations were done when a police killing would occur. Just to talk briefly about the incident, it was a young black guy aged 19 years old, whose name is Anthony Griffin. He was shot on November 87, just in the actual parking lot of Station 15 in NDG in Montreal. It started with a cab fare that was not paid by him, and the cab driver called the police. And once the police officers were there, the cab driver didn't want to press charges, but still Alan Gossett, a police officer of the Montreal Police Department, decided to check on Anthony Griffin, and while he didn't handcuff him, he did bring him at the police station, and at the police station in the parking lot, according to Alan Gossett's testimony, he didn't remember. In fact, doesn't remember pulling the trigger, but still. He shot Anthony Griffin in the forehead, who died from the bullet. And after that incident, there was a big inquiry called the Bellemare Commission that was set by the Quebecois government through police relations between visible minorities and the police. And what happened the next day, after the next day of the incident, was that the police chief at the time, Roland Bourget, didn't want to even divulge the names of the people involved in the incident. But 2 days later, it was found that the police officer, Alan Gossett, was involved in a prior incident in 81 in which there was a racial prejudice. And that's the element that sparked the outcry as much as a report from a journalist stating police sources alleging that Alan Gossett would have said to her partner, "I'll show you how we arrest a nigger and don't run," and even though like this statement was later deemed be untrue or unfounded, there was a massive outcry after the incident. There were demonstrations and big criticisms from the community. So that's the reason why we go as far is to state that this incident is a big example setting up the tone of the kind of relations that went throughout the years in the 80s and the 90s between communities of color and the police. The first incident I just talked about, the Anthony Griffin and Alan Gossett case in which Anthony Griffin died, is an incident that took place in 87. But if we go in 1990, there was another incident in which another person of color, at that time, his name is Jorge Chavarria Reyes. On November 22nd, 1990, he was actually in a dépanneur, a corner store, and he took a little bit of food and he was arrested by a police officer of the Montreal Police Department who did actually shot him. Even though the incident, the police officer was in charge at the time, while in the Anthony Griffin's case, Alan Gossett was charged. In the Chavarria Reyes case, it was a Salvadorian refugee, Jorge Chavarria, and he was a person of color, and he was shot, and he died from the incident. Another incident in April 1990, and when I refer to these incidents, it's not to say that all police officers involved in the incidents were guilty or bad of doing what they did, but it's just to say that amongst these incidents, there's an actual response from the system. Actually, they were quick on denying that any racism could be involved in the incident, even without having to make without having any investigation whatsoever, even though there were big demands in the Anthony Griffin to have a public investigation in the case. In April 1990, Leslie Presley at the Thunderdome Bar on Stanley Street, he was shot, another incident, and he was shot and killed by the police. But in that incident, there were claims that he was actually armed and he fired a shot, even though the findings of the coroner inquiry were unclear. The actual police officers involved admitted in the coroner investigation bringing their own weapons at the police station and counting themselves the shells they had in their guns. And just to go a little later in the story, in 1991, in that case, when this, I would say the second most important case of the series of cases I want to talk about tonight is the Marcellus Francois case, in which a young black guy was, I would say, erroneously mistaken from an attempted murder suspect. The police officer involved in that case was the chief of the SWAT, who was following a car for a few hours. And in that case, the black person who was killed, there was the coroner investigation in which there were allegations. Well, it was found, and it was one of the findings of the coroner investigation that at the scene when there was the stakeout, there were racial slurs in the radio communications amongst the police officers, but still there were no criminal charge with the police officer involved. At the end of the process, there was even the policeman who fired the shot, who said, again, I don't remember pulling the trigger. He was completely white. I mean, there was no sanctions whatsoever. The only sanction that came out of the ethics committee process was another police officer involved amongst the 20 involved in the stakeout who had made a forcible entry in a house to make a search was found guilty of doing an illegal entry in a house. Another incident, this time again in November 91, Osman Seymour Fletcher. This happened in Little Burgundy. There was a foot chase after some police officers recognized him because they claimed there was an arrest warrant out on him from the Toronto police for a little time. And so they chased him, and there were witnesses who were saying, though, that he tried to stop a car and threat the car with a gun. He was involved in a scuffle in which he would have died from his own gun, so he would have suicided himself. The important aspect to talk about, to underline in the Osman Fletcher case, just going back in the Marcellus François case, was the fact that both men knew each other, as well as a third man, Kurt Haywood, who was the actual attempted murder suspect, who would have been the potential target of Michel Tremblay, the police officer involved in the Marcellus François killing. The last incident I want to talk about, I know I'm going really fast on these incidents, and in all of these incidents, only the first one I referred to was actually led to a criminal charge against the police officer. But the last incident I wanted to refer to is Martin Soiseau in 1995. It was on May 31st. Again, after a minor offense, shoplifting at a store, he was chased by some Montreal police. And while he was handcuffed on the ground, according to the police officer, his gun went off. And in that case, Martin Soiseau was a Peruvian, and he was a visible minority. So these incidents, but not to mention Trevor Kelly in 93, where for another time a person of color was killed by a police officer, in I would say unresolved circumstances, these incidents, they show how when there is an investigation in such an incident, at first, in the Anthony Griffin case, it was the Montreal police who decided on its own responsibility to investigate the case. And at the time, the policy was that if an incident takes place in a police station, then it should be another police force who would investigate. But since that particular incident, the policy was changed as a result of the inquiry of the police commission. And since then, the policy is now that when an incident takes place where a police officer is involved in the death of a person, it has to be another police force who would investigate. So all the other incidents that I was referring to were investigated by the provincial police. But even though that was the case in these other incidents, from my perspective, there was a lack of transparency in the investigations, mainly given the fact that there is a solidarity amongst police officers, solidarity that sometimes put the actual good of the police force before the actual research for the truth in investigation. I'm saying that sometimes that could taint an investigation, and particularly in incidents in which person of colors are involved. In Montreal, there was, just to go back in the Anthony Griffin case, and I would finish with that, The police chief of Station 15, at the time, Clovis Coallier, made a declaration just after Alan Gossett was fired after a recommendation of the police commission. He said that at Police Station 15, black are only making 10% of the population, whereas there are suspects in 40% of crimes that are reported here. And he was saying that just to further the argument, his argument that Alan Gossett's firing was actually acting as a scapegoat to appease the black community. So that particular statement, to my humble opinion, is an example of how the police solidarity might taint, especially in that case when the police, Montreal Police Force, did investigate the case, might taint the objectivity of the investigators.
So I'd just like to say a couple of words by way of transition. We'll probably take like a musical break after your presentation so you know how it'll go. But I just want to remind folks that this discussion that you're hearing tonight was recorded at Union United Church. And the discussions will continue on the following two Mondays. On Monday the 17th, we'll be talking about the relations that exist among youth, entrepreneurs, and police amongst communities of color in Montreal. And then on the following Monday, we'll be talking about taking action on improving police relations with communities in communities of color in and on the island of Montreal. So do drop by. The doors are open between 6 and 9 p.m. And again, the location is Union United Church, 3007 De Lille, located near Metro Lyon-Grue. If you want any information about these community discussions that are happening throughout the month of February and are airing right here on CKUT 90.3 FM, you can contact CKUT's Community News Collective at 398-6787, extension 2593. We're going to take a brief break and come back and hear from Peter Flagel as well. We'll hear from Peter Flagel from Black Youth in Action on things that are happening today concerning police relations among communities of color. But we'll also hear more from David. There are plenty of questions that his presentation has already struck up in terms of the quickness that police were responding to all of the incidents that you outlined. It's quick to say that no racism is involved, and so it'll be interesting to hear Peter comment on some of today's encounters with police, particularly around incidences that occur within communities of color. How quick are they to respond that there is no racism involved? Do they take this issue of racism within their police forces seriously? And also the whole question of what happens when criminal charges are laid, because you had said that the first case that you had mentioned was the only one in which criminal charges were laid back in 1987. What kind of justice would be served, though, to police officers if these commissions, whether it's the Ethics Committee or the Human Rights Commission, were more effective in bringing charges against police officers? Once officers get into the system, maybe we can talk about the case of Giovanni Stante. What kind of justice is served in the end? So we'll be back in just a moment from and hear from Peter Flagel with Black Youth in Action. Church being recorded on February the 11th, and there will be two more discussions concerning police relations among communities of color here in Montreal. For day one, this discussion is concerning the history of police relations within communities of color, and we've heard a brief summary of that history from David with the collective Opposed to Police Brutality, and now we'd like to move to Peter Flagel, who's the political coordinator for Black Youth in Action, for an assessment or a reflection on what that history means today concerning relations with police officers, but also other public service officers as well in our community.
Well, I think after listening to David's presentation, I've come to realize that to a certain extent there's been a shift in the relations between communities of color and the police force, away from what I could consider murder to more of intimidation, harassment, and physical abuse or physical attacks. I have to say at the get-go that I'm not an expert on the issue. I don't think there's even been any research, really concrete academic research done on the topic. So what I'm basing my perspective on is just hearing people coming to talk to us, and also members of our own organization who've had experiences. So I think, I guess, a good place to start with is an initiative that was just launched last week, actually here at Union United Church. It's called Mothers Against Racism, which essentially is a regroupment of mothers from visible minority communities whose kids have been harassed or even beaten by either police officers or metro security officers. And they essentially joined together to say that enough is enough. Enough's enough. We don't want our kids to be victims of harassment and brutality anymore. We're taking the steps to bringing them to court. We'll launch complaints to the Human Rights Commission to ensure that this doesn't come in. So it's really a grassroots movement, a bottom-up movement, in which the victims themselves and their family and friends are empowering themselves to put an end to the whole problem through legal means, which I think is perhaps a difference between the ways in which the community mobilized in the past, in which while there were lawsuits that were launched, a group of people didn't necessarily come around to launch a bunch of complaints at the Human Rights Commission or brought police officers to court. So I think that's a positive element in terms of the relationship, or at least within communities of colors, that a lot of people are beginning to realize that there's a problem and realize that there is legal recourse. And so hopefully this will become a larger movement where we have literally thousands of mothers launching complaints at the Human Rights Commission to essentially force the police force and the STM to finally sit down and acknowledge they have a problem and that steps need to be taken to address it. Unfortunately, in Montreal, we don't have what happened in Toronto, which was the Star, which is a major newspaper in Toronto, did a study on thousands and thousands of arrests and found that there was really evidence of racial profiling. Blacks were treated even more harsher for the similar crimes than white people that were charged or arrested. So that essentially proved Beyond any doubt that there was discrimination and racial profiling and intimidation going on in Toronto. Fortunately, we don't have that evidence here, so all we can rely on is anecdotal evidence. So in terms of the things that we're hearing from people on the street, essentially that many are just being beaten for apparently no reason. We have one member of our organization who actually brought a police officer to court and actually won for having been arrested for no apparent reason. He was accused of committing a crime, which at the end of the day, when people actually looked closer into the whole issue, found it was absolutely ridiculous. And so he was bright enough to know that he could take the necessary steps to defend himself. But the problem is that most of the victims of this type of abuse don't know the different steps that can be taken, that should be taken, seek recourse, or they don't believe that they'll win their case, so it's even worth it. They just give up. And that's something that I think many police officers and metro security officers are aware of, the fact that many of these victims are either from immigrant families or very poor, so you know they have limited access to information for one, and I guess a limited desire to take the necessary steps to defend themselves. So then it's very easy to abuse these people and get away with it because they're not gonna say anything. So essentially, while the murders of visible minority people by police officers has really almost, I guess, disappeared. Brutality, racial profiling, harassment is still quite very much a problem in the city, and I think what we need, as far as I'm concerned, is another Star study in Montreal. Maybe, well, I doubt La Presse would do it. Maybe the Gazette or something would do it, to just identify the problem, demonstrate that the problem exists, and then force them to take the steps to you know to uh, to combat it. So, and I think basically it shows that today, despite the various charters, human rights charters, this and that that are out there, the life of a visible minority is worth less than that of a white person in front of the law, which is extremely problematic and shows that Canada hasn't really gone all that far in terms of interculturalism, multiculturalism, and interracial relations. So it would be really almost utopic to believe that the hope that the police would suddenly decide, well, maybe we should take steps on their own, take steps to, you know, eradicate systemic racism within the police force, where really they need to be pressured, put into the corner to do that. In terms of the data, you're right, the police force do, and the Société de Transport de Montréal do have the data, not necessarily divided, not necessarily assemble in terms of looking at racial discrimination, but they have the information there. But from what I understand, and I guess Eric, the police man, will be able to correct me, they are bound by some bylaw which doesn't authorize them to look at race. And I know that's what happened in Toronto. They weren't allowed to. The police force wasn't allowed to break down the data in terms of race. So that's why the Toronto Star had to do the investigation. So I don't think. I might be wrong because I'm not an expert, but I don't think they have the authority to do so, at least the Montreal Police Force. However, the Human Rights Commission, for example, has the authority to do that, and I think that's one of the steps or one of the strategies that the Mothers Against Racism are looking at. They're actually going to be submitting a petition signed by at least 1,000 mothers on the 21st of March, which is Anti-Racism Day, the day, International Day for Elimination of Racism, where they'll be demanding that the Quebec government undertake an independent and public investigation into racial profiling. So I guess essentially doing the same study that was done in Toronto, but in Montreal. So that's clearly on in the plan. So, and hopefully that if there's evidence for racial profiling, that'll be really devastating for the police force. So they won't have a choice finally to take the necessary steps. In terms of legal recourse as well, from what I know, there are at least two. Three, actually, for victims. One is the Police Ethics Board, the Commission de Déontologie Policière, which is essentially a police ethics board where they just investigate complaints brought against individual police officers. And there's a Human Rights Commission, which doesn't necessarily investigate brutality, but if there's evidence of racial discrimination or any other type of discrimination, they'll investigate. And then you can go to court, civil lawsuit, or what have you, which is is very costly. In terms of the most effective, well, many of us have problems with the first, which is the Police Ethics Board, which is essentially police investigating police. And as David mentioned, you know, there's the police solidarity going on, so that which could trump justice or impartiality or neutrality. Not to say that there aren't any neutral police officers investigating, but there is always that perception, that possibility. So that's clearly not in the best interest, I guess. And I'm not sure that they have the necessary training to look at, to really understand what racial discrimination is, to really go deep into understanding the different facets of racial discrimination. So that's my impression. Then there's the Human Rights Commission, which is an independent body which does investigate discrimination claims. And that's a good recourse if you're lucky, because historically they haven't been very good at investigating complaints of police brutality or racial discrimination by the police force. Although that's starting to change, they've actually acknowledged that they don't necessarily have the tools to investigate systemic discrimination. So they're in the process of working on improving that. So we'll see. Remains to be seen what gets done. And also there's a problem in terms of their willingness to investigate racial discrimination. I think it was in 2001, Maître Rivière, which is a judge on the Human Rights Tribunal, hinted that the Quebec Human Rights Commission really was not investigating racism properly, because while at least 25% of visible minorities experienced racial discrimination, the Human Rights Commission only sent like 4 or 5 complaints to the tribunal for prosecution. So clearly something was going wrong at the Human Rights Commission, and the Human Rights Commission obviously didn't like that, but that kind of showed that there was a problem there. the Human Rights Commission is not necessarily perfect, but it's at this point, it's for victims who don't have a lot of money, it's the, one of the best recourses. Otherwise, it's, you know, civil suits, which cost like thousands and thousands of dollars, which so it's not necessarily the best thing to do. But so as far as I'm aware, those would be the three areas, and the Mothers Against Racism are really looking at the Human Rights Commission and putting pressure on the Quebec government for results.
It seems like with most of the options that you've outlined, the recourses all end up in the court system eventually, if I understand you correctly. But there, in response to the sort of history that's been outlined here, it seems that David was indicating that we've gone, or at least you've gotten this the sense from David here that the police relations among communities of color has sort of shifted from murder to intimidation and physical abuse, and that is obviously going to be bringing more and more complaints before these commissions and these committees, and thus more and more activity within the justice system. But in terms of the justice system being served up by police on the streets of Montreal, you, Peter, had indicated that it's clear that at the end of the day, the life of a person of color is of less value whenever it concerns relations with police, or the sort of justice that police serve. And so I guess the question that we can sort of move to is, what is the life of a person of color once they get into the justice system itself, into the courts, especially when they have a complaint lodged against a police officer?
Mm-hmm.
So these are the sorts of bigger discussions that we want to ask with these 3 days of panel discussions being hosted here at Union United Church. The doors open from 6 to 9, and the next discussion will be held on Monday the 17th. We'll take a brief break and come back and get Peter's answer to that question of what kind of justice is served, but also take other questions from folks who have gathered here tonight. Again, Monday, the February the 17th, we'll have day two, an assessment of relations among youth entrepreneurs and police in Montreal. And day three, we'll talk about taking actions on improving police relations within communities of color here in our city. And that's happening on Monday, February 24th, all happening right here at Union United Church. Recorded on February the 11th at Union United Church concerning the history of police relations within communities of color in Indigie, Côte d'Neige, Little Burgundy, and other areas on this island of Montreal. Here tonight we have David, who's a member of the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality. He's provided us a synopsis of the kinds of relations that have occurred amongst police and communities of color on this island at least since 1987. And we've also heard from Peter Flagel, political coordinator with Black Youth in Action. The question that I posed to Peter before the break was concerning the value of a person of color on the streets whenever they're interacting with the kind of justice being served up by the Montreal police. And Peter, your response to the sort of history that David laid out was one that concluding that the life of a person of color whenever it comes to dealing with police officers is often of less value. And the question that I have is concerning all of the recourse that people do have to deal with police brutality, that recourse often ends up in the justice system. And so I wonder what your faith is in that justice system to pay greater value to the life or the rights of a person of color, greater value than what is served up to them on the streets of Montreal every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I wouldn't be able to give an answer because it remains to be seen what's going to happen. Because I think, and I guess David can correct me if I'm wrong, the difference now that we're starting to see now is that many people are beginning to launch complaints, whereas I don't think there were as many people. There wasn't like a mass movement to launch complaints at the Human Rights Commission in the past. Am I correct?
Well, what I can say is that I don't have particular statistics about the Human Rights Commission, but just to add something to what you just said, in 2001, 2002, the figures of the Ethics Commission were that out of all complaints that were laid, 15% of them would go through the an investigation and actual charge against the police officer involved. And of those 15%, only a tiny fraction would actually end up at the end of the process with an actual sanction, being ranging from a warning up until firing, which happened three times within a 13-year period. You know, you can count the times when the most serious sanction is used by the Ethics Committee on the fingers of your hand.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, and that was my earlier point about how the Ethics Commission was not necessarily the best route to go for anyone. But my impression, from what I understand, is that there wasn't this mass movement to launch complaints of the Human Rights Commission. And I think strategically what is effective about that is that that puts a lot of pressure financially on the police forces to either finance or to settle out of court or actually to agree to whatever compensation is required at the Human Rights Commission. So, and I think while on the one hand the justice system does seem to devalue the life of a visible minority, I think it can nonetheless be used strategically. We always have to be strategic with these things and find the best strategy in order to use these institutions to achieve whatever goals that we have. So I guess it remains to be seen if we can be effective, if the Mothers Against Racism and other people can be effective in strategically using the different tools that are at their disposal to bring about change.
I'm going to present myself. I think Peter mentioned me a little bit earlier as he was speaking. My name's Eric. I'm here as both a representative of the black community, which I'm part of, but I'm also a police officer, so I'm very much concerned by the discussion that we're having here, because I feel that in order to improve the relations between both sides, discussion is necessary, and this is obviously a good forum. So before I start, I have a few questions for Peter in particular. But I wanted to make a comment concerning what he said a little earlier. You started off your presentation by stating that you felt there was a shift from murder to intimidation or physical abuse on the part of the police force towards community. And I think it's a dangerous statement in the sense that to systematically conclude that every time a black person dies or feels intimidated, that there's a murder that occurred, or that it is intimidation on the part of the police department. It's not an equation that's to be made without, you know, like you mentioned, the investigations, the findings, and whatnot. Secondly, I had a question regarding what you were talking about as far as racial profiling, amongst other things. To start off, what's your definition of racial profiling? I wanted to establish that before we go any further.
Okay, I guess to answer the first point, clearly, if a person of color is physically assaulted or by a police officer, does not mean that the police officer was being brutal or being violent. But I think if you listen to the description of the investigations into the cases of in which people of color were killed in the 80s and the 90s, there's clearly evidence of racial discrimination, and it's even highlighted in some of the coroner's report. So I think as a representative of the community and listening to people on the street, this is the impression that many people have, and I think there's quite a lot of evidence in the investigations that were done, that there is a problem of racial discrimination within the police force, and that was in part a cause for the deaths of these people. In terms of the definition of racial profiling, well, there are various, but I think what I consider racial profiling is when a person is arrested or stopped only because of the color of the color of their skin, or you know, their physical characteristics, when that is the only identifiable characteristic. This is not to say that if a person if a police officer stops someone based on a variety of factors, including the skin color or their physical characteristics, that's unacceptable. That's clearly acceptable because if, for example, it's a person that was dressed in red clothes, was black, and had a cap on their head, and the police find somebody who's dressed the same way, then that's completely acceptable just to inquire or stop the person to ask what's going on. But if it's, for example, a black person who has an afro and then a black person with braids is stopped, and who's light-skinned, whereas the criminal, the person who committed the crime was dark-skinned, then clearly that's a case of racial profiling because all the police officers relying on is the race of the individual. So that would be an example of racial profiling compared to the other one.
It seems like, Garrick, that Okay.
Just going back to the first point, Peter, concerning what you mentioned about David's finding. By no means did I mean to imply that that race is never a factor in any case. And as you mentioned the findings that were found, and where race may have been a factor. What I was simply pointing out is that to systematically say that every time a black person feels intimidated, or there is physical intervention, or that there is unfortunate death, I'm saying to systematically say that it's a racial, there's a racial motivation behind that. I'm saying that's where I think there's a problem. I'm not saying that it never comes into that it's never a factor. I think that would be utopic, you know. But I'm saying to systematically say that it does, I think, is a mistake. Going back to the racial racial profiling, I think, and this is where the discussion part, I think, is important. I think people have to realize that, you know, like I mentioned before, although there have been strains in the past between the community and the police department, I think something that has to be taken into consideration that most officers, like everybody else who does a job in everyday life, want to be effective. They want to be efficient in their work. So, you know, they want to do their job right. So for an officer to arrest somebody who doesn't fit a description, say, it's not in your interest, because eventually, more likely than not, the person will be let go because it was obviously not them, and it reflects bad on your record, regardless of race relations. I'm just talking about as a professional. It just doesn't look good. So it's not in your interest as an individual to do that. You know, and again, I'm saying this is regardless of color. As an individual, you know, you want to be recognized, be it by your peers or by others, as someone who does a good job. So it's not in your interest to systematically go after people who just don't fit the description. Now, I'm not saying that instances haven't occurred where there might have been abuse as far as that's concerned. I'm not claiming that, you know. But I'm saying that, again, you know, the system, to systematically say something is based on race, I think it's dangerous grounds, because it puts even more strain on the relations that sometimes, you know, are already delicate. And I think, you know, it's really important to, you know, be careful of the words that we choose when we describe those types of situations.
But I hear what you're saying, but if we just look at the Toronto report, the study that was done, it clearly demonstrated that there was a systemic problem.
I can't speak for Toronto.
I'm saying clearly, but I think that there are similarities in practices and experiences between both cities. We, listening to people talk, we hear the same thing in Montreal and Toronto. The only difference with Montreal is that we don't have the data in front of us, so that's why we're calling for the data. But as far as the community is concerned, there is a systemic problem. Whether or not, granted, there are police officers that make the effort to do the work properly, and clearly, granted, it's not in their interest to do that, but doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. So I'm just talking about the perception, and the evidence tends to weigh. And it's not only in Toronto. There was an investigation in Seattle also that found the same thing in New York. And everywhere we go, any major North American city, there's that concrete evidence. So, I mean, as far as the community concerns, yes, not every police officer is a bad, evil person, but there is among many this systemic problem.
I'd like to just bring David back into the question, the man who brought the research with them, because there's this question that Eric has asked, and Peter has tried to deal with it, versus asking the question around, is this an individual problem or is this a systemic problem? I believe that Eric feels that it's not a systemic problem, that you can't just point to the system without the evidence. And so this question arises, is it an individual problem or is it a systemic problem? And that is, in fact, the one of the goals for these community discussions is to ask this question of, is it an individual problem or is it a systemic problem? And I would just like to add that coming from Eric's comment that it's not in an officer's interest to do their work badly, well, it's not in their interest to be openly racist. So they're you know, perhaps is racism within the police forces, but again, it's not in the best interest of their job to be openly racist. And Peter giving the examples of the studies done in Toronto, Seattle, New York City, North American culture in general, there have been, you know, these sorts of pushes within institutions where power is heavy towards anti-racism training. And so that might be one of the things that we want to talk about when we get to talking about solutions within Montreal's police forces to talk about anti-racism training. Would an officer on the street be able to define what racial profiling is, for example? Do they know what it is themselves? David, did you want to respond to some of these issues around the individual versus the system?
Well, first, I would say that why the Anthony Griffin Allen Gossett case is so important is because after the incident, even though there was a big push to have a public inquiry into the incident, the government didn't want to have a public inquiry into the Anthony Griffin Allen Gossett's case directly. So that's why the government decided to have rather an inquiry into relations between visible minorities and police. And the findings of that actual commission, public inquiry, who gave his findings in 89, was that the actual civil oversight of the police in Quebec had to be changed. From a police commission who just had the power to recommend sanctions, which was the case at the time, to the actual police ethics committee we have right now, which instead of having just recommendation power, would have enforced decision power. I want to say that just at that incident, the day of the incident on November 11th, 87, at Station 15 in Montreal, there was an actual course on sensitivity towards visible minorities at the station. And after the inquiry, there was a committee that was set up to deal with tensions between visible minorities and the police. And even if that committee was set up and the public investigation that was made, the Bellemare Commission that was made in 89, events took place in 1990 and 1991, and after 1991 there was even a recommendation from the Yaroski report, the coroner report, to have to no longer have the police investigate these incidents. One of the recommendations of the Yaroski report was to have civilians investigate these incidents. After the Trevor Kelly's death in 93, there was another recommendation by another coroner to again have civilians investigate incidents in which there were deaths at the hands of the police. But these were recommendations that were not followed by the government. And but to go on the other level to say if there's a systemic problem, I want to say that after the Anthony Griffin's case, Alan Gossett, the police officer, was first brought into a criminal trial from which he ended up being acquitted. And after that, and in parallel, because I know to say that a police officer is involved in such an incident, he has to face various forums, the disciplinary, the ethics committee or the police commission at the time, the civil if there's one, the criminal one. All these forums are tiring and because they last a long time. But in the case of Anthony Griffin and Alan Gossett, you know, after being acquitted, he got into the police commission, which recommended his firing, and he was fired. And after his firing, there was a petition that was passed amongst the police officer of the Montreal Police Force that was saying to the police chief at the time, Roland Bourget, you can talk in the name of the politicians. You can talk in the name of the community, but you can no longer talk in our name. Because they were saying what I was referring to earlier, by the police chief of Station 15, that Alan Gossett was used as a scapegoat to appease the black community. So that petition was signed by 3,800 out of the 4,000 police officers of the Montreal Police Force, stating to the police chief, you can talk in the name of the community, you can talk in the name of the politicians, but you can no longer talk in our name. A few months later, the police chief, Roland Bourget, resigned. So that was in the Anthony Griffin's case. To go in 1991, in the Marcellus Francois case, in which a SWAT police officer, Michel Tremblay, mistook an informant he had 2 years back, Kurt Haywood, for Marcellus Francois. He actually knew the informer. He said that in his testimony. He was transferred by the police chief at the time, Alain Saint-Germain. He was transferred to another position within the police force, and it was before the finding of the coroner, even though like there was already plenty of evidence that the whole operation was a major blunder, but because I'm not saying that myself. It was said by the Montreal Police Department, by the coroner, and even by the public inquiry who took place afterwards. But my point here is to say that after the transfer of Sergeant Michel Tremblay, there was a demonstration by 2,500 police officers stating urgent chief needed. And in that demonstration, they were saying, you know, again, that the fact that transferring Michel Tremblay, who shot Marcellus Francois, was against their essence. I mean, they were opposing the decision. They were saying it was unjust and unfair. It's a question of judgment and evaluation of the evidence at hand at the time, but at the same time, looking back at these incidents right now, it shows that the question of solidarity that I was referring to earlier, and even more recently, because actually I didn't mention it, but I released a report in 1998 at the Poitras Commission, who was investigating the police provincial police force, which actually was the investigating body in all these other incidents except but Alan Gossett's case. And the provincial government acknowledged the fact that there is, at times, a solidarity that could end up being harmful solidarity that could exist amongst police force. And this was a finding of the Poitras Commission, and furthermore, this led to a change in the legislation. The actual law that governs police right now here in Quebec states that a police officer who's aware of an investigation of another policeman, he has to reveal what he knows. If he doesn't, that's an offense. These elements, they come into play in a set. They don't come individually. When I refer to these elements, I refer to the history of the past and the actual changes that led to the current situation we're in right now. But my final conclusion to my intervention is to say that even given all these changes that were made, the conclusion of the Malouf report, there were so many investigations and committees that were set throughout the years to deal with police relations between the black community and the police force, and all of them, you know, concluding almost the same thing, really. Like, we ought to talk, we ought to discuss, which is good, but at the same time, the situation didn't change over the years, but we end up arriving at the conclusion, which was the Malouf conclusion, that a police officer on the street has his discretionary power, and he exerts it, and he needs that discretionary power. So that's why the judicial system won't enforce any rules or norms that could entail that discretionary power. So even though we have written the charter, we have written these principles on the street, there has to be that leeway. And that leeway gives what it gives.
Here at Union United Church, and you could be here as well, the next two Mondays we'll be hosting day two and day three of these discussions. Doors open from 6 to 9 p.m., and day two on Monday, February 17th, we'll be hosting an assessment on police relations amongst youth entrepreneurs and police in NDG, Côte des Neiges, Little Burgundy, and other areas of our city. And day three, happening on February the 24th, we'll be talking about taking action on improving police relations within communities of color in Montreal. Again, these questions keep coming up that lead to future discussions, necessary discussions that we should be having in our community, which is why we're here at Union United Church, and you're invited to be here as well. The address is 3007 DeLille, and we hope we can see you here next time. We're going to close out with a few more responses and questions for our panelists as we're quickly running out of time. But there is this issue of discretionary power and this sort of necessary leeway that's been reinforced by the system that has scrutinized the sort of abuses that have happened. There is this need for discretionary power, and David has sort of left us with an open-ended question as to what influences that discretionary power, and it seems that one of the themes that's coming up in tonight's discussion is racism. And so that will be an interesting issue to take up again in some of the future discussions, is how do you put constraints on the discretionary power that police have or influence in a way that eliminates racism or other sort of power trips that play out there. Any more questions or comments?
Just a comment on what David said concerning the solidarity issue amongst officers and perhaps making the whole thing a systematic instead of individual issue. I think, as in any other body, you're going to have a solidarity that's present there, I think, and I think to a certain extent it's healthy. You need a certain solidarity amongst officers for them to be somewhat effective. But you pointed out to the petition, for example, that was signed. I think, you know, the solidarity issue is a good point, and it leads to the conclusion that it's a good thing, I think, that neutral bodies lead the investigations whenever something tragic happens. In the case of the petitions, I think it's a reflection of one thing, one particular thing. There's quite a few of us sitting here, and I'd come to the same conclusion about you guys that I would about the colleagues that I work with every day. I don't think anybody takes it's a difficult thing to just take a man's life. Even if someone's a racist, there's a big line to cross between being a bigot and taking a man's life. And I think that, again, in society, I think, you know, sometimes police officers are a reflection of society, you know, and in society, you have a lot of racist individuals. To say that they're going to kill somebody because they may be racist, may or may not be racist, I think, you know, there's a big step to take. And I think when people sign a petition, it's because what they're telling others is that we don't think that this guy took some man's life just because of his color. I think that's the statement that's being made. It's not to say, you know, he may or may not have had prejudice against the person. He may or may not have. I don't think that's what the petition is about. I think what the petition states, and I'm going on a limb because I don't know this for a fact, but I think what the petition states is that they don't believe that the person that they work with would take a man's life just because of his color. Now, concerning the discretionary power, which Gretchen was talking about, I think, you know, in the past it's something that's necessary to do the work that we do. I think it may sometimes, though, lead to situations that can be problematic, but I think the further back we go in history, I think we can see something that takes place. It's somewhat of an evolution within any type of police department. I think that comes with, you educate your personnel, you know, and you have, nowadays you have more and more minorities, and like it or not, you know, that's going to have an impact on your police department. The more minorities take place, the more people learn about minorities, the more comfortable, because you know, I think often what happens is there's somewhat of a discomfort between minorities and the police department, which historically has been like white males all the time. And I think that's, you're starting to see the picture change, and automatically I think that's going to change relations. And I think, you know, you still have many problems to work out, but I think it's something that in the long run, the more people work at it, the more you're going to see improvements. And you're always going to have individual cases which need to be addressed. But I think overall, the situation can't help but get better if you work on it.
If I may, and I guess, sorry to have to get back on your case again. Yeah. But listening to everybody talk, I just remembered another study that was actually the only study that's available in Montreal, which was done last year at UQAM, which was looking at the attitudes of the police force towards different ethnocultural communities. And what they actually did was interview visible minority and ethnocultural community police officers within the force. And the conclusion was, despite the fact that these visible minorities and ethnocultural members had increased within the police force, the actual culture and the relations of power within the police force had not changed. They were still confronted by a very racist police culture where individual, like for example, black or Italian officers were on a routine basis subject to racist comments, racist jokes about Italians and blacks. So this was not an individual as part of the culture. And I guess the other issue that I have is just have a problem with the idea of evolution, because should black people or visible minorities or people of color have to be the victims of the police force evolution? Like, can they get it together? Like, get your stuff together now so we can go move on. But I agree, I guess I'll try and end on a positive note, that collaboration is essential between visible minority communities and the police force, because especially in the black community, a lot of violence is essentially destroying black youth, drugs, and other issues. And without that collaboration, the problem will increase. So we have to find a way to collaborate. But my little pitch to the police force is that y'all need to get your act together in terms of anti-racism training before that collaboration can work.
So Eric here has made the suggestion in terms of representation, but also training. And Peter, you feel like they're, in addition to that, there has to be a sort of element of collaboration. And David, I'm just wondering if we can put this to you, since you have a lot of the results there that have come out over the years in terms of police relations and the sort of systemic things that happen over and over again, not only around specific incidences, but also what happens when these incidences get put into the systems of accountability that are in place. So I wonder if you have any sort of thoughts on where to go from here as we sort of try to wrap things up.
Where to go from here? That's a big question. What I have in mind is the example of Arlene Antoine, the first black woman of the Montreal police. She was fired a few years after, and amongst the reasons she was fired was the fact that she gave a wrong address. I have also in mind the first case of a worker in Quebec who would actually be awarded workers' comp for psychological depression. I think he was a black officer with the MUC. To state where we would go from here, I believe that the actual police function, not only here in Montreal, but throughout the Americas, had to undergo serious reflection. What I want to refer to when I talk about police function, the actual cliché we have that the police are there to arrest the bad guys. Who are the bad guys, and what is bad today it might be different from what was bad in the 20s and the 30s. And my feeling is that people like Kenneth Lay, the actual CEO of Enron, is not the kind of guy who would be thought of as being the bad guy, even though he wears a tie and a suit, he looks nice, but the kind of crime he would commit are not the actual elements of the broken window theory. If you spit on the ground, then it's something that ought to be eliminated. But if you do tax fraud, well, it doesn't show up the same way. And that's the kind of path that I think that the police function, the reflection on the police function should take.
So it goes larger than Montreal to throughout the Americas. The discussion will continue here at United Church, Union United Church, on the 17th of February, that's this coming Monday, for an assessment on relations among youth entrepreneurs in police. These are open forums. We have invited panelists, but anybody from the Montreal community can attend, and anybody will have an opportunity to speak out. That's day two coming up this Monday, February 17th, for an assessment on relations among these communities. And then day three, we'll be looking at taking action on improving police relations within communities of color in Montreal. And that's coming up February 24th. Doors open at Union United for these discussions from 6 to 9 p.m. And Union United Church is located at 3007 de Lille near Metro Lyon-Grue. We hope you'll join us here next time. And if you want any more information about these discussions, you can reach CKUT's Community News Collective at 398-6787, extension 2593. This has been a special presentation of CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project, assessing police relations within communities of color in Montreal. Do stay tuned for day two and day three. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Century still poor, world war they want me to kill for. What happened to the future they always predicted? With new science fictional things and space business. I seen two sides, us against them. Police troops riding with 4 to 5 men. Prison business is booming, senators grin. People searching for answers, where to begin? Capitalism born from the backs of blacks. White folks relax, live off the kickbacks. Didn't work to the bone, Joe, built this country. Further exploited by class to make money. Filthy rich capitalists with blood loot. Use mainframe systems to bank and compute with the next technology. Credit through the wires. Internet growth, demand more suppliers. Welfare, elderly checks and wage workers. All us, elephants trapped in a circus. Ain't fighting over man-made chips no more. When the lights go out, it's gonna belong to the poor.
Right. called Shot the Sheriff and all that. Just the fight with